Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, members of the panel. My name is Richard Podol. I'm arguing on behalf of eight of the appellants. Mr. Coles will be using 2 minutes of our time to present some argument on behalf of Double R Coffee. This almost feels like deja vu, but not quite. This case started out as a case of great complexity. As a result of the trial, the first appeal, the remand order, and the remand, the order on remand, we're now dealing with very narrow and well-defined issues. In the first appeal, the court reversed the trial court's conclusions that written disclaimers precluded plaintiffs' reliance on a non-disclosure claim. Specifically, the court held the written exculpatory provisions did not preclude reasonable reliance on the non-disclosure of the parent company's losses. Because the trial court's ruling was based solely on written disclaimers, this court remanded, and the remand order asked the trial court to resolve inconsistencies in its decision relating to the duty to disclose, intent, reliance, and the liability of the individual defendants. In returning the case to the trial court, the court specifically directed remand to Judge Robbins, who had tried the case and since 2009 had presided over a criminal division. The trial court in its remand order emphatically affirmed its prior factual findings that the Peabody defendants had a duty to disclose further facts that would dispel a false impression about the profitability of Peabody Coffee based on republication of a newspaper article that contained false information about profitability and affirmatively false statements made by defendants Toyton or in the franchise sale process. The trial court then turned to intent. The definition of intent in a non-disclosure claim has been consistently accepted by the Colorado courts as the plaintiff might have acted differently than he or she acted if the true facts had been disclosed. The derivation of this definition is from Morrison v. Goodspeed, a 1937 landmark case, and it's repeatedly been affirmed in cases such as Copigan and Ackman. Further, the honest motive defense has been routinely rejected by the Colorado Supreme Court in the Court of Appeals since the Morrison v. Goodspeed case in 1937. Despite this clear precedent, in their briefing on the remand order, the Peabody defendants argued to the trial court that the correct standard of intent for a non-disclosure claim involved a corrupt motive, and argue for the standard announced in Ronald Winings' case by the Supreme Court. Ronald Winings was a Consumer Protection Act case, not even a fraud case. The trial court, the standard they argued for was intent to mislead and deceive the plaintiff. The trial court adopted the Peabody defendants' arguments and held, additionally, Colorado law requires proof of an intent to mislead and deceive a plaintiff instead of mere proof of reckless indifference. The trial court then cited Ronald Winings.
Mr. Podol, let me ask you a question based on that, because it looks to me that the trial court's order states that it finds that there was no action with the requisite intent or recklessness. And so I'd like you to respond to that, because I think what I understand you saying is you don't need to have the to have an honest motive. But if the court here is finding there was not a requisite intent or recklessness, what would that play on your argument right now?
Well, I think the gravamen here is the trial court believed that a corrupt motive was necessary. You can call it whatever you'd like, but the trial court's opinion is clearly predicated on its belief that a corrupt motive is necessary. That's also stated in Section G of the order, where the trial court, and again, this is a section that was proposed by the Peabody defendants in the original order and was edited by the trial court, but the trial court didn't edit this portion, which says, noting general rule that actions based on fraud involve corrupt motive on defendant's part. Now, the trial court here was talking about the affirmative misrepresentation claim and the non-disclosure claim. The trial court in the original order went on to make specific findings on non-disclosure that fit the intent element of a non-disclosure claim. But the trial court has always acted under the standard that this was a corrupt motive standard. From the perspective that this was a corrupt motive standard, and that's really what's wrong here. The Peabody defendants, in their own briefing, define the mislead and deceive standards to lead another into error, danger, or disadvantageous position. That's the difference in the standards. The difference in the standard is the victim might have acted differently. Is the intent just the victim act? The victim would have been led into danger, error, disadvantageous position is the victim would have been harmed by acting. That's what the trial court felt was necessary for the plaintiffs to prove as far as the intent element of a non-disclosure claim. The intent element of a non-disclosure claim is a very low bar. The fight in a non-disclosure case and why there's such a paucity of case law in regard to intent is over the duty to disclose. Once there's a duty to disclose and the facts aren't disclosed, it's not excused by honest motive. You don't have to show there was an intent to deceive and mislead. We even pointed out in our briefing where you're dealing with rescission damages, which we are at this point, you don't really even have to prove intent. It's an extremely low bar. And if you look at the facts of this case, the only facts in record on intent, and it's crucial to remember, the duty to disclose arose in the sales process, the sale of franchises. That's where it arose, by the publication of newspaper article false information and affirmatively false statements by Mr. Choyton and Mr. Orr. That's the totality of the evidence of intent. You take Mr. Choyton and Orr's false statements and their testimony that they knew that the franchise disclosure rules provided they couldn't provide any information about the parent company. Piecing those two together, the only conceivable explanation as to why the false statements were made is that, and the truth withheld, is that a franchisee might have acted differently had they known that this parent company that the franchises were based upon had lost $1 million a year for 10 years. So we're talking about a very, very low bar. We talk about intent, and we're talking about the trial court applying a corrupt motive analysis, which is wrong. And there's frankly no evidence in the record, if the correct standard were applied, from which the trial court properly could have concluded that there wasn't an intent as required by the non-disclosure claim that the franchisees might have acted differently had they known about these $10 million losses. So the intent issue is a low bar, and frankly, we think it can be determined as a matter of law based upon the factual record for those reasons. I think reasonable minds can't differ if you put together those two facts. First fact, Toyton and Orr lied about the company's profitability to the franchisees in the sales process. They knew they weren't supposed to say anything. Why would they do that? Orr testified that if they had told the truth, it wouldn't sell franchises about factors including the company's loss. So I don't know that there's any other evidence, and I don't think reasonable minds can differ. Now, moving on to reliance.
Hey, with our point, in your brief, you argue a distinction between would and might.
Right.
Did you specifically argue that below on remand?
Oh, yes. In the remand order, we argued that the standard was might.
Did you draw the distinction between would and might?
Yes.
Okay.
And Justice Law has a great discussion of this in Ackman. And in Ackman, the Supreme Court specifically rejected the Wood standard as being too stringent a standard, because that means something that the victim actually would have done, whereas might is a much more lenient standard, a much lower bar, just that they might have acted differently. If these franchisees had known of 10 years of $1 million losses, might they have decided not to buy a franchise? Might anyone have decided not to buy a franchise? That's the intent element in a nondisclosure claim. Moving on to reliance. This court rejected the trial court's holding that exculpatory provisions precluded reliance and asked for actual reliance findings. All that the trial court did was verbatim reiterate its findings on written disclaimers. Never made actual reliance findings, never reached liability of the defendants. We would respectfully submit, and Mr. Cole has 2 minutes and I'd like to try to reserve 2 minutes, but we would respectfully submit that this case has to be reversed because the wrong standard, clearly wrong standard, was applied in finding intent. And if you drop down to the next level, if you use the right standard, there's no evidence to support a finding that Troyton and Orr made these statements without the intent that the low bar intent in a franchisee might have relied. The question is, where do we go from here? We believe the remaining issues on intent, reliance, liability of defendants are largely rhetorical questions and can be answered by this court as a matter of law. If remand is necessary, we would ask that the case be remanded to the Civil Division from where it came. Unfortunately, Judge Robbins has shown that he can't put his feelings and prior rulings out of his mind by reaffirming his findings, which his court rejected. Frankly, all of the pieces are on the board. Duty to disclose is found. Damages are found and affirmed by this court. Really, at this juncture, these franchisees have been denied justice long enough. Judgment should be entered in their favor for the amounts found and affirmed by this court. If we remand to a civil division, a civil judge can easily and very efficiently deal with any remaining issues that this court believes exist. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bruce Cole is appearing on behalf of Appellant Double R Coffee, LLC. Double R adopts almost all of Mr. Podol's argument. The only main difference between Double R and the other appellants is that we are not seeking judgment against Mr. Toynton and Mr. Orr. Rather, we are seeking judgment and a reversal of judgment in favor of the two Peaberry companies, which would otherwise allow an award of attorney fees under the existing franchise agreement. We don't think there's any need for new findings to be made by the trial court in order to reverse. There's plenty of unrescinded findings in the original trial court's order and again on the remand order, which would allow this court to enter judgment as we requested, going to the intent of Fred Nielsen, the third Peaberry player in this, not just Mr. Toynton and Mr. Orr. That's not discussed really in the remand order, and we think that certainly those findings regarding Mr. Nielsen's role in failing to disclose information are sufficient to find intent. On the reliance issue, we agree with Mr. Podol again that the undisputed evidence establishes that no franchisee would have purchased the franchise had they known the long record of unprofitability of the parent company. That's undisputed. Peaberry, in their response brief before this court, claims that that's self-serving. It may well be self-serving, but it's also only common sense. Who would possibly buy a franchise if they knew the truth about this? Nobody. The district court had its chance on remand to make the correct decision. It didn't do it. It didn't make new findings. It didn't follow this court's instruction on the exculpatory clauses. This court should step in and do the right thing now. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Hugh Gottschalk. I represent the Peaberry defendants. We are here, as Mr. Podol said, on a single issue. The element of intent in a non-disclosure claim as ruled by the trial judge in his remand order. It's important to note that the judge in his remand order cited precisely the standard that Mr. Podol advocates. That is, that the plaintiff had to intend, that the defendant had to intend that the plaintiff act differently by virtue of the nondisclosure. The intent had to be focused on the plaintiff. There's language in the remand order that is precisely what Mr. Podol advocates should be the standard. The issue is, the appellants are arguing that there were a couple of other things added that changed that, that added additional requirement. Neither of those arguments have merit, and I'll address them briefly now. Mislead and deceive is not a new or additional element of intent. Mislead and deceive connotes the same issue that the standard of intent through decades of Colorado law has focused on, which is the intent in the nondisclosure to change the behavior of the plaintiff, or is the intent unrelated to the plaintiffs at all? Is the intent to mislead and deceive the plaintiff, or is the intent something unrelated to the plaintiffs? The case law, Weishart, Kopeikin, Ackerman, all talk slightly differently about how you define and what language you use, but they all focus on, and I'll just cite Ackerman, the intention that the concealment be acted on by the plaintiffs. The intent must be plaintiff-focused. That's exactly what mislead and deceive is talking about. It's taken from the Rhino Lions case, which, as cited by the trial court, had a long section discussing the genesis of the intent standard in common law concealment and misrepresentation claims. The bottom line is mislead and deceive, and this whole issue of corrupt motive doesn't add or change anything. And I'd like to briefly just mention the words corrupt motive.
Before you do that, can you cite us to any non-disclosure case that turns on an intent to mislead and deceive?
I would say the answer is all of those. I would tell you that there's none that I've seen that have those precise words.
Okay, thank you.
But I believe that what the court's talking about, and going now to the corrupt motive, is if I conceal information to impact the plaintiffs, it doesn't matter if I have a good faith motive that I think my deal or my loan or whatever it is going to work out. It's not a defense that my motive in deceiving the plaintiff is good faith. That is a corrupt motive in corrupting or misleading the plaintiff. What is relevant when you talk about corrupt motive is if you had a good faith motive for concealing, that is, you were not disclosing the information for reasons completely unrelated to plaintiffs. And the record below makes clear that the decision not to disclose the information this court has focused on, namely the profitability of the parent corporation financials, that decision was made early in the franchising process without any regard to the plaintiffs. There was no inclination, there was no suggestion, there was no evidence that early on in the process, when the Peabody defendants were meeting with counsel, setting up the franchising system, that they were under the impression they could not disclose parent corporation financials under the FTC rule. This court has ruled, after a lengthy analysis, that that was an incorrect legal conclusion, and the FTC rule does not preempt Colorado common law fraud claims. But the point is, for the issue of intent, there is evidence in the record that the Peabody defendants made the decision not to disclose the PCI financials, not for any reason related to the plaintiffs, but because of other regulatory restrictions and structural restrictions that they arrived at early on in the case. Judge Robbins heard that evidence, has balanced the evidence, and concluded that evidence, as well as all the other evidence, led him to conclude, as the fact finder, that he did not believe there was an intent to mislead, an intent to deceive, an intent to impact the behavior of the plaintiffs. And
Mr. Gottschalk, so as far as the trial court's order, the court did affirmatively apply the intent to mislead and deceive, and your position is that is subsumed into the standard that the court is supposed to look at for the element?
I don't think that's necessarily true. I think they're a similar standard, but I don't think the last sentence in his order, right before he reaches his factual conclusion, he recites the standard that Mr. Podol has said is correct, that the standard is to cause the plaintiff to act differently than he might otherwise have acted. That was the last statement he made. It was the conclusion to his whole discussion.
He ended up citing the standard that everyone agrees is right. The question is whether one places on an earlier statement independent significance. My argument is he applied the right standard and that there it is essentially a synonymous standard that doesn't add anything to the analysis. I'd like to talk briefly about the might be would issue, if I could. First of all, that issue has nothing to do with the issue of intent. Might be would is a materiality issue. Is the standard of materiality that it's so important that the plaintiff would change his behavior, or is the standard of materiality that all you have to show materiality is the plaintiff might change his behavior? And there's a lengthy discussion in Ackman, there's a discussion in Briggs v. Ampac that talks about materiality and whether might be would is the right, or might be would is the right standard, particularly in the Ackman case. The point here is, materiality deals with the quality of the information and the plaintiff's reaction to it, whether it's material or not. It has nothing to do with intent, which is the defendant's motivation or reasons for not disclosing the information. So might is the standard, but it's the standard of materiality, and there is not a materiality issue. We are not before this court challenging, raising an issue of materiality. We are only here with respect to the issue of intent, and we are arguing that the trial court used the right standard of intent, and Mike B. Wood has nothing to do with intent. It relates to materiality. The bottom line on intent is we believe the court used the correct standard. This court has already concluded at page 28 of the prior opinion that the findings with respect to intent were conflicting but not clearly erroneous. There was evidence to support them, and therefore we ask this court to affirm the judgment on the issue of intent. If I could just take a couple of minutes to talk about the reliance issue. What this court told the trial court to do on remand was look at duty, look at intent, and look at reliance. And if at any place along that chain the court found for the defense to stop. So the court on remand did not address affirmatively the reliance inconsistencies, as this court called them in the prior opinion, pursuant to this court's order. The trial court did exactly what this court told it to do and has not addressed the remand issues on reliance. Notwithstanding that, we believe that this court is not required to remand on the issue of reliance. The court, this court, in its remand instructions or guidance to the trial court, said that there were no findings on whether the plaintiffs had relied on the assumed profitability of PCI, the parent corporation. That's at 251 P3rd 24. No findings as to whether the plaintiffs had relied on the assumed profitability of PCI. The court also said that there were no findings as to whether the plaintiffs would have purchased with this information. Again, that's the would-be might. That's materiality. Is this information material so that it would have affected the plaintiff's behavior? We're not raising the issue, and the issue of materiality is not before you. So the only issue this court remanded on that's still relevant is the question of whether plaintiffs reasonably relied on the assumed profitability. The original court's order addresses that very question. The court says at page 12 of its original order, plaintiffs had no reasonable basis to assume anything about PCI's or the store's profitability, so they could not have justifiably relied on the assumption that it was different from what it actually was. And at page 10 of the order, the original order, the trial court says, each of these claims fails here because the plaintiffs have not persuaded me that they reasonably relied on the alleged omissions. Those statements from pages 10 and 12 of the original order essentially directly respond to the remand order. Obviously, the remand order came later. But we believe that without doing any fact-finding, which is clearly inappropriate for this court, that this court can look at the original order, look at what it asked for on remand, and find the answers to those questions in the original order. We believe that there is evidence to support the no reasonable reliance findings. The trial court talked at some length in its original order, quoted again in its remand order, because it didn't go on to do the independent analysis because of this court's instruction, that the plaintiffs asked about the PCI financials. They were told they weren't available. There was extensive testimony about the discussions between the defendants and the plaintiffs in the trial record about the PCI financials and how they would not be able to see them. That would not be something on which they could base their decision as to whether to buy a franchise. That was a significant part of the trial. Each of the plaintiffs, as well as the defendants, had testimony on that issue. And based on all that evidence, the trial court concluded that there was no reasonable reliance shown by the plaintiffs, that the plaintiffs had simply not met their burden of proof of showing, and this is the standard for concealment, that they reasonably assumed anything about the PCI financial information. And based on that, the trial court concluded that the plaintiffs had not proven reasonable reliance. Again, the court on remand did not independently respond to this court's remand order, but I believe the answers to the remand questions exist in the original order. In conclusion, we request that you affirm the trial court's order on both intent and reasonable reliance grounds. And we also ask, I haven't talked about it, but that you independently dismiss the appeal and the claims of the double R plaintiff. There's a settlement agreement that was entered between the parties. There's a pending motion to submit the settlement agreement for you to look at. The claims have been waived. That part of the case has been settled, and we'd ask, in addition to affirming the trial court's remand order and original order on the issue of reliance and intent, that the court independently dismiss the double R appeal.
Why would we need to say anything about the double R appeal?
The answer is you wouldn't.
Thank you.
It's a housekeeping argument on my part.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Very briefly, since we only have a minute. The Peabody defendants are asserting, and this is contrary to what they briefed to the trial court in the remand order, that there is no difference between the intent to mislead and deceive standard and the might have acted differently had the truth been told. If you look at Judge Robbins' order at page 3, he says, additionally, Colorado law requires proof of an intent to mislead and deceive the plaintiff instead of mere proof of reckless indifference. He's setting a higher standard.
Counsel, in the he begins the very next sentence with the word still, that which means. Seems to be a word of qualification. Couldn't this passage, which certainly could have been written more clearly, might reasonably be read as ultimately applying the might standard?
If you take the whole appellate record in context, I'd say no. If you look at the Peabody briefing, they're clearly arguing for a corrupt motive standard. The Rhino-Lining standard is a corrupt motive standard. He cites Rhino-Lining's for the proposition of the intent to deceive and mislead standard. I think if you take it all, as opposed to, parsing out a word, that no. Peabody defendants asked the trial judge to impose a corrupt motive standard. He accepted their argument, he cited their case, and he used a corrupt motive standard. But if you want to drop down, where is the evidence that would support a finding of no intent if the intent were that the franchisees might have acted differently? I'd respectfully submit it's not in the record. Just those two pieces of evidence, since the duty to disclose arose in the sales process, that they lied to the franchisees and they knew they shouldn't say anything. You put that together, what else could they have intended? And I have other points, but I'm also out of time, so thank you all very much.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.